Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the expose of a cache 160 times larger than the WikiLeaks State Department document dump of 2.5 million files that were cracked open by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, exposing the secrets behind more than 120,000 offshore companies and trusts that hide the fortunes and identities of politicians, ruling families, Wall Street swindlers, arms dealers, and the global mega-rich. Gerald Ryle, the lead author of the ICIJ's report, Secrecy for Sale, Inside the Global Offshore Money Maze, joins us. Then we'll look into the staggering corruption inside and at the top of the Chinese Communist Party, which exercises one-party absolute rule over a country in which less than a half of 1% of Chinese families own 70% of the wealth, and where the top 70 members of the National People's Congress are worth $89.8 billion. Peter Kwong, professor of Asian American Studies at Hunter College, who studies modern Chinese politics, joins us. He has an article at The Nation, Why China's Corruption Won't Stop. Then finally, with a report out today showing Germany's economy has slowed to near stagnation, we will assess the implications of the Eurozone's deepening recession on the engine of the Euro, Germany. Thomas Kleiner Brockhoff, a senior transatlantic fellow at the German Marshall Fund and a member of the German Council on Foreign Relations, joins us to discuss Europe's growing north-south creditor-debtor split and increasing concerns over the region's debt crisis and political instability. Joining us now is Gerald Ryle, who leads the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, headquarters staff in Washington, D.C., as well as overseeing the consortium's 100-member journalists in more than 50 countries. Before joining ICIJ, Ryle spent 26 years working as a reporter, investigative reporter, and editor in Australia and Ireland, including 2 decades at the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age newspapers. He uncovered some of the biggest stories in Australian journalism, winning that country's highest journalism award 4 times. He's the former deputy editor of the Canberra Times and a former Knight Wallace Journalism Fellow at the University of Michigan, and is the lead author of a new report by the ICIJ, Secrecy for Sale, Inside the Global Offshore Money Maze. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gerald Ryle.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And this extraordinary cache that you got hold of, and you're certainly welcome to tell me how you got hold of it, which is 160 times larger than the WikiLeaks State Department document dump, consisting of 2.5 million files. You've analyzed these documents and collaborated with reporters from The Guardian, the BBC, Le Monde in France, Süddeutsche Zeitung, Norddeutsche Rundfunk in Germany, The Washington Post, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and 31 other media outlets around the world, involving 86 journalists from 46 countries, using high-tech data crunching and shoe leather to sift through these emails, account ledgers, and other files that cover nearly 30 years. This is, on the surface, is just an extraordinary treasure.
It is, but it was also quite a difficult cache of documents to discover, because it was all very much a mess. There was a bunch of you know, PDFs and spreadsheets and documents and passports and financial details, and it actually took us quite a long time, and it was a very frustrating exercise to put it into some sort of order and for us to realize what we were really looking at.
So it wasn't like the WikiLeaks, which was just from one source on a disk. This was real shoe leather and digging in all kinds of nooks and crannies.
Yeah, well, we had to cross-reference everything that we found with actual events to make sure that what we had was real. So if we had a name and address, we had to make sure that 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 person existed. Or if we found a fraudster in the data, then we would go back and look through court records to make sure that they matched what we had. And over a long period of time and across more than 70 countries, we found that the data was incredibly accurate. And it sort of opened a window into the secret world that no one had ever seen before. I mean, we all thought we understood tax havens and offshore finance, but this was the day-to-day workings of a small slice of it, but a very, very deep slice of it.
And this is a phenomenon that is crippling or at least impeding the functioning of governments, both large and small, powerful and weak. The United States government apparently loses $150 billion a year. The estimated flow or the amount of these offshore financial caches and accounts is between $1 trillion and $1.6 trillion a year. That's how much is what, sent out or held, or how do we come up with that figure?
Yeah, look, the favorite figure I have is from the Tax Justice Network, which is an advocacy group, but they have estimated probably the best figures involved, and they say that a third of all world wealth and half of all world trade is now going through tax havens. So you can see that it's something that's impacting every one of us, even if we don't know it. You know, it means that people are able to operate in different tax regimes than you and I. And I guess it promotes unfairness and imbalance. I mean, defenders of this world will say that you need tax havens to do international business that allows you a sort of a neutral platform to conduct business between two different nations. But, you know, other experts will tell you that, you know, with a little few changes in law, then none of that would be necessary. And it would all be forced to play within the rules of our own nations.
Well, we've seen what happened in Cyprus, which is when you have these distortions because of this offshore money, and presumably a lot of the Russians whose money was being laundered there were avoiding taxes in Russia, even though they're low. But let's just go through some of the extraordinary revelations here. And the first one, of course, deals with Russia, the Magnitsky affair, which has become a sore point between U.S. and Russian relations, and it's something that Putin has railed against. This document expose that you've come up with here, it basically suggests that it actually fills in a lot of the blanks there, does it not? And provides a lot more, sheds a lot more light on the Magnitsky affair.
Yeah, it shows that the offshore service provider, and this is an industry that I'd never heard of before I started looking at this, but there are companies that call themselves offshore service providers, and these are the ones that the banks go to and the accountancy firms go to set up offshore entities for their clients. And there are hundreds of these offshore service providers around the world that we've never heard of before. And they keep a very low profile. They advertise mostly on the internet. And we zeroed in on one of them for this particular story, the Magnitsky affair, because what we were able to show is that this offshore provider had repeatedly broken the rules in its own jurisdiction for years, and that the body that was supposed to oversee it had failed to take action for many, many years. So a lot of the key players in the Magnitsky affair were basically able to use this offshore provider to get offshore companies that perpetrated the fraud at the center of that.
And, of course, the irony is that the man who exposed the fraud, Magnitsky, he's the one that ended up being punished, and the perpetrators are free. So, again, I'm speaking with Gerald Ryle, who leads the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists headquarters staff in Washington, D.C., as well as overseeing the consortium's 100 member journalists in more than 50 countries. And he is the lead author on the new report by the ICIJ, Secrecy for Sale Inside the Global Offshore Money Maze. Tell us a bit about this Venezuelan deal maker that you also exposed.
Yeah, it was a very large Ponzi scheme that was actually gone through the U.S. And again, there were documents linking that and shedding new light on that. Some of that material has come out in court before, but again, we're able to see the mechanics behind it. And that was a pattern, in fact, that we saw in the data, like old mysteries, like, you know, we had new light on them and you were able to see them, the background, what really happened beforehand and what really happened afterwards. And so you're able to, I mean, one of those, you know, being, money in Manila that, you know, was linked to Marcos. What we found is one of, President Marcos's daughter had a secret offshore company, and now the authorities in the Philippines are saying they want to look at that to see if any of Marcos's money is in there.
$5 billion.
Well, he did stash a lot overseas in offshore accounts, and some of it has never been accounted for. So this data gives us an excuse to, or at least gives the authorities an excuse to go back and look again. And, you know, there was an interesting case in Canada that we came across of a guy who'd, you know, disappeared mysteriously and was thought to have been, you know, killed by the underworld. And, you know, we found offshore entities belonging to him. And there were lots of those types of little mysteries inside the data.
But apparently there are 4,000 Americans, and a lot of them are sort of doctors and dentists avoiding taxes. But there are also some prominent names like Denise Rich, whose husband, Bill Clinton, pardoned and got a lot of flack for doing so when he left office. She's using the Cook Islands, right? This sort of last little bit of Polynesian paradise in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, right?
Yeah, we have a document that shows she had about $144 million in a trust account in the Cook Islands. And it's interesting there because, if you recall, Denise Rich gave up her citizenship of the U.S. In late 2011. And it was linked at the time to a dispute that was going on in Florida in a Florida court involving a Cook Island trust. And, of course, this is the same trust. So I'm not sure what the ins and outs of that court case were in Florida, but you were able to – it was one of the bits of shoe leather that we did. We were able to go and get documents from a Florida court that showed that, you know, that matched the documents that we had. But, the use of offshore for those type of purposes among the mega riches was right across the world. I mean, there were people holding, you know, masterpieces, art masterpieces in offshore entities. There were people holding yachts and, you know, all the things you expect to see.
But holding them on paper, not physically, right?
Well, there were some very complicated structures
right.
there.
Where they wouldn't be shipping Van Goghs to the Cook Islands.
No, it was done. No. I mean, was done obviously for tax reasons.
Sure.
And again, you know, I have to emphasize that a lot of what we're looking at here is perfectly legal, and that to me also made it a better story because, you know, you start off looking for illegality, but then you see, hang on, all of this, everything that's going on is perfectly legal. Well, how come I didn't know about that beforehand? How come the average taxpayer doesn't know about that? And why is it legal?
I find extraordinary about your report that you are the lead author on, Gerard Ryle, from the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, Secrecy for Sale Inside the Global Offshore Money Maze, is the idea that you've got a kind of network of felons out there, a multinational network. Like, for example, the Thai official, Natalie Joy Tavisin, who was Thailand's – no, is currently Thailand's international trade representative, and she's apparently a crony of the Zimbabwean dictator Robert Mugabe's wife, and she's a courier or a cutout for their kleptocratic practices of smuggling gems and other deals that are being made. So you've got cooperation between, you know, these despots and government officials in completely unrelated countries.
Yeah, and the offshore world has got very few rules, but one of the rules it has is they're not supposed to do business with people that, you know, that are called P. Well, they call them, they actually have little brand names for them. They call them PEPs, which are politically exposed persons. And this is the term they use for people like that. And they're supposed to screen them and be very, very careful about doing business with people like that. But again, time and time again, we saw that they just, you know, you might have someone who perpetrated a fraud 4 years earlier. It was quite clear that this had happened. It was a very public event. And then these service providers just said, well, you know, you want an offshore entity, here you go.
Well, I noticed that you've quote here at the end of your report, Jack Blum, the former U.S. Senate investigator, who I've spoken to a number of times over the years. He goes back to before Iran-Contra in terms of the investigations that he did. And for the longest time, I've been trying to get an answer out of officials, particularly in Washington, about, you know, why it is it that there's so much criminality involved in offshore money that it's obvious you need more transparency to stop the criminality. But what's stopping the transparency is the fact that you've got the Mitt Romneys of the world also in there. So isn't that the conundrum here, that in effect the super rich, the global super rich, are protecting the global criminal class?
Well, by default, they are, because once you have a jurisdiction where everything is kept secret, then you've got to attract a bad element as well as a good element. That's just the nature of these things. So there's no doubt that a certain percentage of the offshore world is criminal, just as there's a percentage that's perfectly legitimate and above board, and probably some that's a bit grey, and you can't really be sure what's going on. It's certainly, if the authorities had the will, they could close this down if they really wanted to. So you've got to ask yourself why they're not doing it.
So how do our listeners get hold of this report? Because it's really a must read to understand how little we know, that how unfair our society is becoming, and how unfair our tax system is. But this looks like low hanging fruit that something should be done about.
Yeah, well, they can go to our website, which is, www.icij.org. But we have partnered with more than 30 publications around the world. So our publication method is to share and to collaborate, and then, to really have that impact by publishing in so many places at once. But, we think it'll have some impact on policy. We hope it will, because, when you've got a world that's based on secrecy and you breach even a small part of it, then you are shaking that world a little bit, and maybe it'll have repercussions.
Well, we sort of thought it would during the election with Mitt Romney, but he dodged that bullet. But I thank you for the extraordinary addition to the debate that you've just made, Gerald Ryle.
Thank you very much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Gerald Ryle, who leads the Investigative Consortium of Investigative Journalists headquarters staff in Washington, D.C., as well as overseeing the consortium's 100-member journalists in more than 50 countries. Before joining ICIJ, Ryle spent 26 years working as a reporter, investigative reporter, and editor in Australia and Ireland, including 2 decades at the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age newspapers. He uncovered some of the biggest stories in Australian journalism, winning that country's highest journalism award 4 times. He's a former deputy editor of the Canberra Times and a former Knight Wallace Journalism Fellow at the University of Michigan, and is the lead author of the new report by the ICIJ, Secrecy for Sale: Inside the Global Offshore Money Maze. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how stupendously corrupt the Chinese Communist Party is.